Why, O Lord, is a question of the ages. It's a question found often in the Bible. It's found even more down through the history of God's people. It's a question because we can't see all that God is doing. It's a question sometimes as well because we refuse to see that we ourselves are often the problem. Our stubbornness plus God's hiddenness. And then sometimes these collide. They collide in our passage this morning in a spectacular narrative early on in the two-volume work of the book of Samuel. Why, O Lord, is a question of the ages, because we have a God who is just not predictable. But you know what? Here's the thing. A God who is predictable is very soon going to become a God who is incapable of overcoming your sin, of running the universe, of leaving you in awe. If you can put God in a box, that is not a God you can worship. So when it comes to those times in your life, when it's not what you expect, you and I, we have to lean in. Sometimes we ask that question, why? Sometimes he tells us. Sometimes he doesn't. But always he is faithful. Always he is present to those who seek him. It's the time of the judges. It's the time when every man did whatever was right in his own eyes. But we have been prepared by the time we come to the end of chapter 3 for a new righteousness to come forth in the nation of Israel. Judgment has been pronounced on the old leadership, on the corrupt leadership of Eli and his household. The little boy Samuel has been growing there in the temple, and we know and anticipate that he is going to come forth as a servant of the Lord to lead into a new era. All of that rising up is in place as we come to the beginning of chapter 4. But you can't reform an entire community. You can't transform an entire culture just from the top down. The people need a radical change of heart from within. Yahweh now begins that work, but it's a pretty unusual kind of work. First, we're going to find chapter 4 of our passage today, Yahweh inscrutable. What do you do with a God who defies explanation? What do you do with a God who defies explanation? Pick up with me, first three verses, chapter 4. Then the word of Samuel came to all Israel. That's really the close of the last scene. And really, we pick up here. Now Israel went out to meet the Philistines in battle, and they camped beside Ebenezer while the Philistines camped in Aphek. The Philistines drew up in battle array to meet Israel. When the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the battlefield. When the people came into the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why? Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines?" Pause there. Battle with the Philistines, raid, attack by the Philistines. This is something that's seen many, many times through the course of the book of Judges. This is nothing new here at this point, but this one will be like something that no one in Israel has ever seen before. After a defeat, they will ask the question, why has the Lord defeated us? It's that question that's going to drive the next four chapters of the book. They sense that the blessing of God has been removed. They are asking the right question. The problem is they give the wrong answer. They're too quick. They never pause to even ask God, actually, that question. They never begin to reckon with God, even though his name is on their lips. This is avoidance. They will reach a very quick solution that will cost them nothing. They pressure God into helping them, or so they think. Pick up again verse 3. When the people came into the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Oh, let us take ourselves from Shiloh, the ark of the covenant of the Lord, that it may come among us and deliver us from the power of our enemies." Did you see how long they thought about that one? So the people sent to Shiloh, and from there they carried the ark of the covenant of the Lord of hosts, who sits above the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the ark of the covenant of God. As the ark of the covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted with a great shout so that the earth resounded. When the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, "What does the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" And then they understood that the ark of the Lord had come into the camp. The Philistines were afraid, for they said, "God has come into the camp." And they said, "Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us, who shall deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods who smote the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the wilderness. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, or you will become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been slaves to you. Therefore, be men and fight." It's looking pretty good so far, wouldn't you say? The Philistines at this point have practically defeated themselves. We're close to it. The Ark of the Covenant, that chest that held the actual Ten Commandments written on stone by the finger of God, that held the rod of Aaron, the high priest, that miraculously budded to demonstrate God's blessing upon him and his priesthood. This was the place of Yahweh's very presence, that he dwelt there above the mercy seat where the blood would be spilled for the sacrifice of sin. Between the cherubim, he would come and manifest at different times the very pillar of the cloud of God's presence. Numbers chapter 10, the ark used to go out before the people as they journeyed from Mount Sinai in the wilderness. And we're told whenever they went out, the ark would go before, and Moses would say, "Arise, O Lord, and let your enemies be scattered." At the crossing of the Jordan River, the ark led the way, carried on a pole, on the poles by the priests. And they went through the Jordan River, the ark leading the way. They walked on dry ground. The Ark of the Covenant led the military procession as they circled around the city of Jericho, that fortified, tightly shut up city, for 7 days. And the Ark led in military procession until finally, at God's command, they shouted and the walls fell down flat. This is a pretty great invention that God thought up, this box. What did she say? "Hey, let's get the box thingy. That's what we need. Get the box thingy." But this has nothing to do with knowing God. This has nothing to do with meeting with God and being his people. In fact, it's just the opposite. This is manipulation. This is hiding from God. This is using God. This is making God their pawn. This is man-made religion at its worst. You know what the ark is at this point? It's a rabbit's foot that you rub for good luck when things are bad. What's your religious rabbit's foot? What's mine? Something that when you just need a little bit of that, you know, Jesus magic, just need that quick blessing, it never fails. You just do this. You just say your 10 Hail Marys and you're good. Well, I just asked Kevin to pray for me because Kevin's super spiritual and I know God's going to answer him. That'll handle it. You know what I do is I just swear off the bad stuff for about a week and it seems to fix itself. What's your religious rabbit's foot? Look, prayer chains and resolutions have their place. And they can be mightily used of God. But if you're looking for something else in your relationship with God besides your relationship with God to make you spiritual, then that's an ark. That's a manipulation. It's a substitute. It's an avoidance to keep you from doing the hard work of humbling yourself and being honest with God and inviting the Spirit of God, search me, O God, and try me, test me, and know my anxious thoughts. See if there be any offensive way in me. Why, O Lord, is meant to be an invitation for God to do a new work, a mighty work, and the nation refuses. God can't be used. God can't be manipulated. Not even if you go and you get the God-designed box that never fails. Because you can't trust the box. God is near to the brokenhearted. He answers those who cry out to him. But the callous, in mercy, he will bring them up short. Why? Because he loves them too much. He's too jealous for them to just say, yeah, it's good enough. At this point, Yahweh is bringing the nation to terms with the reality that they have been very far from him for quite some time. And at this moment, he is going to use their archenemy, the Philistines, to do it. Verse 10. So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and every man fled to his tent. And the slaughter was very great, for there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. And the ark of God was taken, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died, just like we were told they would. Now a man of Benjamin ran from the battle line, and he came to Shiloh the same day with his clothes torn and dust on his head. And when he came, behold, Eli was sitting on a seat by the road, eagerly watching, because his heart was trembling for the ark of God. So the man came to tell it in the city, and the city cried out. When Eli heard the noise of the outcry, he said, "What does the noise of this commotion mean?" And then the man came hurriedly and told Eli. Now Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were set so that he could not see. The man said to Eli, "I am the one who came from the battle line. Indeed, I escaped from the battle line today." And Eli said, "How did things go, my son?" The one who brought the news replied, "Israel has fled before the Philistines. And there has been a great slaughter among the people. And your two sons also, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead. And the ark of God has been taken." When he mentioned the ark of God, Eli fell off the seat backward beside the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died, just like God said. For he was old and heavy. Thus he judged Israel 40 years. Now his daughter-in-law, Phinehas's wife, she was pregnant and about to give birth. When she heard the news that the ark of God was taken, that her father-in-law and her husband had died, she kneeled down and gave birth, for her pains came upon her. And about the time of her death, the women who stood by her said to her, "Do not be afraid, for you have given birth to a son." But she did not answer or pay attention. She called the boy Ichabod, saying, "The glory has departed from Israel because the ark of God was taken." And because of her father-in-law and her husband, she said, "The glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God was taken." This is the absolute unthinkable among God's people. The defeat has been hard, 30,000, but they've suffered other defeats. That's bad enough. The promise of judgment upon Eli and his household has been fulfilled. "You and your sons will all die in the same day," he told Eli, "and I will put an end to your lineage and your spiritual leadership." That has now been fulfilled. That's hard, but here's what's really unthinkable. The ark has been taken. That thing that they decided to manipulate so that they could force God to do their will, that thing they trusted in, he said, "Fine, I'll let you lose that." Absolutely shocking that Yahweh would even allow such a thing to happen, unless we see why. It's because the ark was taken. This is why Eli capsizes to his death. This is why the wife of Phinehas goes into labor. Because the ark was taken, she tells us. This is why she cries out in her lament and gives one of the most unfortunate names a mother's ever given to a son. No glory. Ichabod. There is no glory in Israel. The author of Samuel is telling us the people have been far from God. And in their pain, God is now showing this to them. Did God create the distance? No, He's just revealing it, right? And notice the lengths to which He will go to get their attention. God ordains defeat in order to fulfill His word. Eli, Hophni, and Phinehas. It's ultimately going to be for the good of the nation. We talked about this last week. But what a shocking thing you would do. God Himself will suffer ridicule, dishonor to the sake of His name in order to eventually bringing about the restoring of His honor. The people are routed. The ark is taken. We will see the Philistines will try to make a mockery of the ark and of the God of Israel. See what lengths He'll go to. He wounds in order to heal. He exposes the distance of their hearts in order to have them desire nearness again. He defies all predictability to stir you to long for Him. Why, O Lord, is the question that God brings us to so that we realize He really is God. And I really have to deal with Him, and there ain't no shortcuts to it. The most shocking part of this entire long narrative is that God Himself will risk disappointing you and disappointing me to awaken us to truly know Him. This is why Yahweh is so hard to figure out. He's inscrutable. You don't know what He's doing. You can't guess what He's going to do next, but He has purpose in all of it. Where have you been disappointed with God? Are those words that you would actually be able to say, or are you more spiritual than that? I don't get disappointed with God. For me, there was a season about 15 years ago. I tried to place it. It's in that ballpark. I had grown very disappointed. I had never put those words to it. God, I'm disappointed with you. I was too spiritual to say that. But I had repeated frustration. I had growing frustration. Whenever the frustration came, I just cast my cares on the Lord. I just pray. And yet I found that over the course of a long season of many months, that the passing issues, the frustrations on the surface would have been dealt with. But growing within me was a disappointment with God Himself that at first I couldn't even identify. Eventually, God in His grace helped me see. He helped me see, holy cow, I'm disappointed with you. And the dam broke. I could have used this passage then. It would have been really helpful if I'd have had it back then. But by golly, I sure see it a whole lot clearer now. I want you to quickly jot down, because I'm going to mention, four lessons about disappointment with God. And this is your homework for these chapters, if you choose to accept it. Four lessons on disappointment with God. Your disappointment with God, ready? I'm just going to rattle them off. Your disappointment with God, number one, is meant to decenter your selfishness. Your disappointment with God is meant to decenter your selfishness. Number two, your disappointment with God is an invite to know Him more. An invite to know Him more. Three, your disappointment with God does not change His character. Does not change His character. And last, it does not mean that He is done with you. Does not mean that He is done with you. That, I believe, is where this passage is going. That is why I want to cover four chapters this morning. Given the rest of our time, I'm just barely going to hit the high points, but you'll have to search it out for yourself. I think you'll see it clearly. But all four of those things are easily confirmed in what Yahweh is doing here in the broad scope of this narrative. This, dear friends, is what we do with a God who defies explanation. We decenter ourselves. We invite. We receive the invitation. We realize His character hasn't changed, and we rejoice that He's not done. Where have you been disappointed with God? Let these four lessons break your heart. Let these four lessons of these chapters rescue your soul and draw you deeply in desire to want to know God. Do you think the nation of Israel at this point finds God easy to figure out? Not a chance. It'll be pretty obvious later in our passage this morning, though, unfortunately, that even months after this event, they are still playing the game, demonstrating that God had to go to these lengths, in this case, to get their attention, until they're ready to stop playing with God and really turn to Him. God will be inscrutable. He will even allow us to impugn His character and be disappointed with Him if that's what it takes to awaken us to who He truly is. For Israel at this moment, their disappointment is palpable. But the first step back is this: the God that they've dishonored is now about to once again bring honor back to His name. We see this next in the long section dealing with the Philistines and then Israel. We find Yahweh untamable. When God takes matters into His own hands, Yahweh untamable. Chapter 5, first three verses. Now the Philistines took the Ark of God and they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. And then the Philistines took the Ark of God and they brought it to the house of Dagon and they set it by Dagon. When the Ashdodites arose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and they set him back up in his place. It's always a bummer when your God falls down. You got to like prop him back up again. It's like, wake back up. No, catch him. No, okay. You got him. Is he good? Easy. It's a bummer when you have to set your God back up. Although, unfortunately for us Philistines, we do that all the time. When our gods fall on their face because they're not God and they don't deliver what we think they should promise us, we set them back up. But that's another sermon for another time. The bigger bummer is when your God decides to worship another God. Now you're really like, well, what in the world am I doing at this point? Pick it up in verse 4. But when they arose again early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face to the ground before the ark of the Lord. And the head of Dagon and both the palms of his hands were cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. Therefore, neither the priests of Dagon nor all who enter Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. Now, the hand of the Lord was heavy on the Ashdodites, and he ravaged them and smote them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territories. When the men of Ashdod saw that it was so, they said, the ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is severe on us and on Dagon our God. So they sent and they gathered all the lords of the Philistines to them, and they said, what shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel? And they said, let the ark of the God of Israel be brought around to Gath. And they brought the ark of the God of Israel around. Pause there. This is comedy. This is just a fun passage given to illustrate a point. The untamable God is deadly serious about His glory. That is a thread that runs through these chapters. The glory of God. No glory is where we begin with God's people, because finally they see it with their own eyes. We have left it. Here the Philistines have come and they have set the ark up as a trophy in the house of Dagon. This is like when you go hunting, men. What do you do afterwards? Check out my trophies. That's what it is, right? In the house of Dagon. Check out. We conquered Yahweh. He's like the God of Israel or something. Anyway, that's his box. Our God did that to him. And yet the problem is that the ark is just wreaking havoc on the Philistine gods. The presence of Yahweh in Ashdod is giving people disease. And so the Ashdodites convene a gathering of the heads of state. Now, apparently the mayor of Gath didn't get the memo, and he was absent that day. And so since he failed to attend the meeting, everybody else volunteered. Let's send that bad boy to Gath. And so they bring it around. Gath will get the honor of hosting the Ark of the God of Israel next. Well, you can guess what happens in the rest of the story, and I'll let you enjoy it. Suffice to say, the Ark will be passed around to several of the cities in Philistia. And wherever it goes, there is fear and panic. There are tumors and mice. There is disease and death. But here's the thing in verse 6. The hand of the Lord was heavy on the Ashdodites. The same word and same phrase is going to be repeated a few verses later on, a second time. Would you be interested to know that the word heavy in Hebrew is the same word for glory? Chabod. The hand of the Lord was glory on the Philistines. This is God's weight upon them. If his own people reject his glory, fine, he will have to restore it himself. And that's what he's doing at first among the nations. Eventually, the Philistines are going to get the point after trying to pass. I don't want the ark. You take the boat. Let's send it down the road. We don't want the ark. Eventually, they get the point. And they've had enough. Chapter 6, verse 1. Now, the ark of the Lord had been in the country of the Philistines 7 months. And the Philistines called for the priests and the diviners, saying, "What shall we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us how we shall send it to its place." So they gather again and they make a plan. They get all their religious folks and they consult all their superstitions. And they say, "What's the best way to just get rid of this hot rock? Because we can't handle it." I'll let you read the details on that. But they're also doing something else. They're not just doing the superstitious thing of how do we get rid of it. They're performing a test. It's a test on the God of Israel. It's a test on Yahweh to find out if all of this is really Yahweh stuff or not. Pick up in verse 7 of chapter 6. This is the command given by the diviners, the spiritual experts. "Now therefore take and prepare a new cart and 2 milch cows on which there has never been a yoke, and hitch the cows to the cart and take their calves home away from them. And then take the ark of the Lord and place it on the cart, and put the articles of gold which you return to God, to Yahweh, as a guilt offering in a box by its side." This is part of their superstitions. "And then send it away that it may go. Watch. If it goes up by the way of its own territory to Beit Shemesh, then God has done us this great evil. But if not, then we will know that it was not his hand that struck us. It happened to us by chance." And so the men did so, and they took 2 milch cows, and they hitched them to the cart, and they shut up their calves at home. They put the ark of the Lord on the cart, and they boxed with the golden mice and the likenesses of the tumors, and the cows took the straight way in the direction of Beit Shemesh. They went along the highway, lowing as they went. They did not turn aside to the right or the left. And the lords of the Philistines followed them to the border of Beit Shemesh. Drop down to verse 16. "And when the 5 lords of the Philistines saw it, they returned to Ekron that day." Huh. So here's how the test worked. They got some nursing cows, and they took their calves away from them. Do you think that makes happy mama cows? That's the first. And then they take and they put a yoke on them, who have never had a yoke on them before. And then they hitch them to a burden, and then they say, "All right, we're just going to see which way they go. If they smell their calves and they head that way, then we know this wasn't a God of Israel thing. But if they go up to Beit Shemesh, then we'll know God has done this." And everything happens entirely contrary to all nature. God delivers for them the exact sign for which they have asked. The Philistine lords were looking for a miracle, and guess what? They got it. And then what did they do? They said, "Whoo, I'm glad that's over with. Let's go home." Those who demand miracles sadly rarely benefit from them, even if God decides to do them. This is tragedy in Philistia. In this case, God answers enough so that hopefully the humble amongst Philistia, I mean, are you kidding me? Their God got face planted and then decapitated. And like everywhere the ark goes, it's like, what a coincidence. And they're like, "Okay, well, let's just test it by a quick miracle-y thing." And it happens. And they're like, "Well, sure glad he's gone. What's for lunch? God in his mercy is appealing to any in Philistia who would be willing to realize that the God of Israel, Yahweh, is the one true God over all the gods of the earth. Friends, if you've ever felt disappointed with God, receive the honor that God himself is inviting you. He's drawing you. He's relishing for you the opportunity to lean in and get to know him. He's doing it at this point for the Philistines. Here we see, even in the most unique of all situations, the unchanging character of God, because he is both at one and the same time the God of all glory, who will thwart and humble his adversaries, put them to shame, put them in their place, and at the exact same time, the God of unspeakable mercy, that he would demonstrate to them, all right, you want me to do a parlor trick? This is a piece of cake. Send the cows wherever I want to. Just so they can see it, so that those, if they have eyes to see, and they miss it. All of this, my friends, is a setup for what happens next. We won't have time, but I'll just tell you, this is the key for what happens next, because the tragedy grows more tragic, because the scene will repeat itself. But now it's not going to be amongst the Philistines. It's going to be amongst the people of God. And God will demonstrate both his incredible kindness and goodness and mercy, and they will worship him for it. And then they will act in profound presumption, demonstrating once again they're still playing games with him. And so he will defend his glory. And they will say, too hot to handle. They'll do exactly what the Philistines did, and they'll say, send him away. Good riddance. Call the people from Kiriath Jearim. Tell them to come get the box. Because when God doesn't fit in our box, that's when we should lean in. Just like the Philistines, the Israelites then send the ark away. So they're still callous. Good news is God is beginning to soften their hearts, and all of this is slowly beginning to have its effect, and they are starting to feel it. Chapter 7, verse 1. And the men of Kiriath Jearim came, and they took the ark of the Lord, and they brought it into the house of Abinadab on the hill, and they consecrated Eleazar his son to keep the ark of the Lord. From the day that the ark remained at Kiriath Jearim, the time was long, for it was 20 years, and all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. Paused there. After all of this that has just happened, guess what? 20 years. 20 years of living at a distance from the very presence and richness and sweetness of God. 20 years the people will languish. 20 years of lamenting after the Lord, of longing for nearness, for them to eventually have it break through their hard-heartedness. We're living stupidly. We're living stubbornly. This is a problem now of our own making because of their disappointment and their own self-protecting pride. Until finally, a man comes. The one who's been conspicuous by being unmentioned for the last 3 chapters. His name is the title of the book. A man who's no longer a boy. 20 years have passed, and the little boy in the temple, the prophet whose word has gone forth and Yahweh has let none of his words fail, we're told at the end of chapter 3, is now raised up to step forward, and he appears on the scene. Roused by Samuel, the people once again finally see chapter 7. Yahweh is accessible. They'll find how God has already provided. How God has already provided. Verse 3, then Samuel spoke to all the house of Israel, saying, if you return to the Lord with all your heart, remove the foreign gods and the Ashtaroth from among you, and direct your hearts to the Lord and serve him alone, he will deliver you from the hand of the Philistines. So the sons of Israel removed the Baals and the Ashtaroth, and they served the Lord alone. And Samuel said, gather all Israel to Mizpah, and I will pray to the Lord for you. They gathered to Mizpah, and they drew water, and they poured it out before the Lord, and they fasted on that day, and they said there, we have sinned against the Lord. And Samuel judged the sons of Israel at Mizpah, Now the Philistines heard that the sons of Israel had gathered to Mizpah, because the Philistines always hear. And the lords of the Philistines went up against Israel. Ooh, isn't this where we started? And when the sons of Israel heard it, they were afraid of the Philistines. And then the sons of Israel said to Samuel, "Do not cease to cry to the Lord our God for us, that he may save us from the hand of the Philistines." Samuel took a suckling lamb and offered it for a whole burnt offering to the Lord. Samuel cried to the Lord for Israel, and the Lord answered him. Now Samuel was offering up the burnt offering, and the Philistines drew near to battle against Israel. But the Lord thundered with a great thunder on that day against the Philistines and confused them. Pause there. The people finally return in earnest. See the lengths to which Yahweh has gone to disappoint his people, to defend his name, to confound all expectations. Why? So that eventually they would go, "You know what? I guess we really have no other hope." And Samuel, God's appointed man, steps forward. In tender mercy, the Lord invites them to return and to find a lasting peace. What are the elements necessary to pave their return? Three found quickly in this passage. There's an earnestness, there's a mediator, and there's a substitute. What's the earnestness? You can just look at the commands in verse 3. Return to the Lord. Remove the fake gods among you. Direct your hearts completely to the Lord. In other words, stop trying to manipulate and play games. Stop trying to just say, "Hey, we can fix this by, you know, rubbing the rabbit's foot," or whatever. And serve the Lord with your whole heart. And you know what? God has already provided exactly the access to that earnestness for you. How? Because in the new covenant promises, it is said that when Christ comes, that he would take your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. God says, "I'll give you a heart that I can move so that you will walk in my ways. You will know me." It's part of the provision we have in the new covenant in Christ. How much more, even more than they did to respond, do we now have his presence so that if we lack it, we can find an earnestness. Second, a mediator. Samuel prays there in verse 5. And then he leads the whole nation in fasting. And they pour out water. This was not a commanded ceremony. There's wonderful guesses at what this might mean. I think broad agreement, as this is a symbol of their pouring out their hearts to their Lord, a symbol of their total dependence upon God, of their giving of their life. We find that in verse 6, the fasting from food, depending entirely. But all of it is led by Samuel. And this is exactly what God has already provided for you, a mediator, because in Christ, Christ now lives to intercede for you. He prays for you at the right hand of the Father even now. You have a mediator. So when you're so disappointed and you're like, "Oh Lord, why have you defeated us?" There is one in heaven who understands, speaks to the Lord on your behalf. There is a spirit within you which prays with groanings that words cannot express. You have a mediator. For this inscrutable God, so that you can draw near. And finally, there's a substitute. Verse 9 is the whole burnt offering. There's the suckling lamb that Samuel will offer, acting now as the priest, taking up this role, and it is received by Yahweh. And so in the same way, God has already provided for you, because Scripture says that Christ gave himself for us to redeem us from every lawless deed and to purify for himself a people for his own possession. I am not enough. I am hard-hearted. Oh my goodness, I'm actually disappointed with you. I didn't even realize that was, no wonder I'm far away, Lord. That's why I made a substitute, is because you'd never be able to do it on your own, my children. He says, "So my son did it for you." All of this is available to us, brothers and sisters, and all of it is dependent upon Christ. Many times I have, and I bet you can say the same, I've asked the question, "Lord, why? Why have you defeated us?" You find yourself asking that question, realize that the Lord is inviting you. He's inviting you to truly know him. He's a God you can't figure out, but his character hasn't changed. And if you're asking the question, it means he's not done with you yet. But he is so willing to decenter your selfishness. He is so willing to reveal himself to you as who he truly is. He doesn't always answer, but I do know what those questions are meant to do. He doesn't always explain, but I do know because this passage shows us what he is doing. And I think, walk through the details and revel in it for yourself. Verse 10, the Lord thunders against the Philistines. And you know what's cool? That's exactly what Hannah said would happen back in her song. Chapter 2, those who contend with the Lord will be shattered. Against them he will thunder in the heavens. They are the people for his glory once again. The Philistines are routed. Samuel sets up a stone of help. Literally, stone of help in the Hebrew, Eben Etzer and Ebenezer, verse 12. Then Samuel took a stone and he set it between Mizpah and Shane, and he named it Ebenezer, saying, thus far the Lord has helped us. From Ichabod to Ebenezer, these four chapters go together. See why we had to take them all this morning? When life hands you a defeat, when you feel like God himself hands you a defeat, and you find yourself disappointed with him, and you know there's no glory in it, do you play games? Or do you let it do its terribly uncomfortable work of decentering you from your selfishness? Do I let God do that in me? Are you leaning in? Are you building a testimony for tomorrow so that you can look back and say, I have laid a stone and thus far God has been my help? Because that's what he wants from the testimony of his people. And that is glorious, that he will do it. From Ichabod to Ebenezer. Stand with me, let's close in prayer. Week.